Last week we began to see how a deeper, more contextual understanding of this book that we tend to skip in our Bible reading, because let's be honest, it's dense and from our perspective kind of boring and seems unrelevant and unrelatable. But last week we started to see how understanding what is going on here in its context helps us to understand better the layers of meaning that the New Testament authors are drawing on as they talk about and use this language from this book to talk about things in the New Testament and the New Covenant, especially relating to Christ and to the church and to our relationship with Christ and what he has done for us. So we're going to continue that journey as we look today at chapters 2 and 3. These chapters talk about the grain offering and the peace offering. The first thing I like to do with each offering is to talk about the purpose of it. Last week we saw that the purpose of the burnt offering is to be a gift from God, a gift to God from somebody seeking to enter sacred space or his presence, which at that time was the tabernacle complex. Basically, once you got to the gate of the tabernacle complex, the understanding was that you are essentially entering God's yard, and then the tent of meeting was God's home, is kind of the understanding of what's going on there. So as they enter the gate, they are initiating this burnt offering that is basically saying, I am entering God's presence, and here's my gift so that he hopefully accepts me. And we talked about just a lot of different layers going on there. But that's essentially the purpose of it. It's kind of initiating this entrance onto sacred space, whether it's for the purpose of prayer, guidance, or usually to be then followed up by some other form of offering or sacrifice that then follows up this initial entrance. These next two offerings are usually offered immediately after the burnt offering, because like I said, the burnt offering is kind of like the entrance or the warm-up to a lot of stuff. But these next two offerings are usually offered right after it, and they each have a different purpose. And this kind of, they follow up to the burnt offering, is why you see, by the way, in 3:5, we'll get to there later, but you see that the peace offering is burnt on top of the burnt offering. That's because, again, it happened right after. The grain offering, this first one in chapter 2, we will see was a reminder of the covenant relationship that the people had entered with God, which is another reason I had Exodus 24 read for the reading today, so we can kind of remember what that setting was too. The burnt offering and the grain offering were the daily offerings that God commanded the priests to make. So these first two chapters, the burnt offering and the grain offering, these are not only what you see spelled out here that anybody can do, but also the priests were commanded that these two were done every day, morning and evening. There's basically a continual thing going on, which is significant when you think about the meaning of both of them. Because basically the burnt offering is I want to have fellowship with God, and then the grain offering is we are in covenant with God. So essentially, the priests were commanded to twice a day, constantly and continually, give a visual reminder to themselves and the people that they long to have fellowship with God, and God longs to have fellowship with them, and that they are in covenant with God. So there's a continual reminder of that happening. The next offering, the peace offering, which, depending on your translation or study Bible or whatever you're reading, might also be called the fellowship offering or the well-being offering or even some other things that are floating around out there for names. That's because there's a little bit of ambiguity going on in the wording. We'll get there later. But usually this was used for requests, for thanksgiving, for vows, or as a free will offering. And real briefly, what these kind of four categories, what's going on here is request was usually for like a deliverance from enemies or from sickness or from hardship. And thanksgiving was usually kind of the follow-up to the request. Like, they requested deliverance from something, and then they come back later to do a peace offering for thanksgiving for the deliverance from the thing that they requested earlier. And then the third one is the vow. A lot of times this vow was made in the context of there's some sort of difficult circumstances going on, and I'm going to make a vow to God that if he helps me through this, I'm going to do X for him. And you actually see this fairly often in the Old and even in the New Testament alluded to, where it's basically kind of a deal being brokered with God, for lack of a better way of putting it, that like, if you help me, I'm going to do something in return for you. Like, I'm going to do some sort of service for you or do some sort of like commitment of time to do X. That's usually what was going on there. And then the free will offering was usually a spontaneous act of generosity prompted by some sort of goodness received from God. oftentimes this honestly happened in the harvest season, where it's like, God, you gave us a good year. I'm going to give you not only what I'm due to give you in the first fruits offering, which we'll talk about later, but I'm also going to give you extra as a free will offering of generosity because I am so thankful that you were so good to us this year. And not only, by the way, was this given at harvest time, but also it could be given at any time, and even not just in times of like extra blessings from God. It could just be like normal times that like it's just normal life, and I'm just grateful that I am in relationship and covenant with this God, and I just want to do a free will offering. So that's usually what was going on there with the peace offering, which is chapter 3. These three offerings often worked together, and you can almost make a narrative out of them, as a way for one person to say, I want to spend time with God, burnt offering, to remember the covenant I have with him, grain offering, to either give thanks or make a vow to him, peace offering. So a lot of times, honestly, all three of them happen in succession to each other. So why I want to start with the purpose of each offering is that oftentimes we read these chapters and it's like, okay, they're dissecting this animal and the fat goes here and the entrails go here and the meat goes here and this person eats it. And it's like, we don't care. And honestly, the reason is that we don't know. What does this mean? What on earth does this have to do with anything? And part of the reason is that, I mean, if you look at these chapters, all of the purpose that I just gave you, it's not necessarily laid out here in these chapters. And one of the things going on there, and we'll talk about this again later with some details in these chapters, is Moses is assuming that this is not the first chapter of what he's written that you're reading. He's assuming that you kind of know other things that are going on in the Old Testament. And he's also, honestly, probably just assuming that his readers, the original audience, knew a lot of the context and purposes of what was going on, some of which we don't necessarily know fully today. There's a lot of stuff going on in the Old Covenant that we have a lot of debate nowadays of what exactly is the nuance of this exact detail or whatever. And sometimes it's just simply that it was assumed that everybody knew because this was the culture they lived in. It's like when we talk to each other, I don't feel the need to explain every meaning of every detail of every word that I say to you. And if we did, conversation would be so cumbersome that nobody would talk to each other. We'd get bored so easily. Because there's like words, when we use them in our context, normally don't just have like a dictionary meaning like X means Y, X means X, like short one word each equivalent. It's usually like X means big long idea and like kind of more of an encyclopedia than a dictionary. And that's oftentimes what's going on in the Bible too, is that there's a lot of cultural packaging that's going on behind a word, some of which we don't necessarily know as much nowadays. But luckily, a lot of it we can figure out because we have evidence of stuff, we have archaeology, we have all sorts of contemporary literature. There's a lot of different things that we can look into to figure out what exactly is going on if the Bible itself doesn't actually spend the time to lay that out for us. So all that to say, those are the purposes of what's going on here. So again, last week talked about burnt offering, which is basically I want to have fellowship. And then chapter 2, grain offering, is I am being reminded of the covenant that I've entered with God and that I have with God. And then chapter 3, the peace offering, is usually one of four main categories, whether it's request, thanksgiving, vow, or free will offering. So those are the purposes. And with that, we're going to start digging into chapter 2, the first one, the grain offering. Now I'm going to kind of take this by sections here and then dig into some of the more maybe weird or just kind of details that stick out. And that's kind of my theory for all of this book, by the way. And you'll notice as we go forward, sometimes I'm going to do multiple chapters, like even five chapters I think I do at one sermon. But I'm really just trying to help us understand the main points of what's happening and maybe some of the weird details of what's happening. So starting in chapter 2, verse 1. When anyone brings a grain offering as an offering to the Lord, his offering shall be a fine flour. He shall pour oil on it and put frankincense on it and bring it to Aaron's sons, the priests. And he shall take from it a handful of fine flour and oil with all of its frankincense. And the priest shall burn this as a memorial portion on the altar, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. But the rest of the grain offering shall be for Aaron and his sons. It is the most holy part of the Lord's food offering. It's a short paragraph, and to us doesn't seem like a huge deal, but there's actually a lot going on in just this first paragraph of this offering that I'm going to unpack for us. The first thing I'm going to talk about is this food offering language. Because I mentioned last week that when you see food offering, you should probably actually be thinking, and you might even have in your Bible, depending on what footnotes you have or whatnot, but a lot of times it's actually translated as offering a fire. I would probably argue that a better translation even, and some translations have this, would be gift offering, especially with the burnt offering, because again, it's basically a gift to God, almost like a house gift when you're invited to somebody's house. It's like, I want to have fellowship with you, here's a gift, please accept me onto your sacred space. And that's similar, there's still a gift idea going on with this one and the next offering. So I'd offer that we should really be thinking of like gift of fire or like offering a fire, gift offering, some sort of language like that. But then you might look at this chapter as you keep reading and wonder, okay, so we're not supposed to think food offering, but this is literally food. So what's going on? Now, obviously, animals are also food, but this one is like just straight up food. It's like flour and oil and frankincense, and they cook it, and then they give it to God. So it's like, okay, are you sure we're not supposed to still be thinking food? Remember that last week I mentioned that what is going on in the sacrificial system, the rituals, and even the appearance of the temple, this is all meant to be a visual scripture to the people, because honestly, at most, they probably had one, maybe two copies of what was written down at that point. It wasn't normal like it is now, where everybody has a copy of scripture. And because of that, what they see, smell, experience, all of these rituals and stuff, that's all meant to teach. And I would argue that's part of, and in fact, the majority of what's going on here. The Israelites knew full well, or at least should have known, that God was not physically there eating any food, especially since he does not need any food. And we see that explicitly spelled out in Psalm 50, where he like goes on for a few verses about like, I don't need your food. And if you think that's what's going on here at the sacrificial system, and that you're like using this as a bargaining chip for me like the other nations do, just get out of my house. Don't do that. Like, I don't need that from you. However, what we see here is a symbolic act, such as offering of food, which has actually a teaching purpose, not a actual, like, God is eating purpose. So what's going on here, and honestly also with, we'll get to the stuff later, but like the bread of the presence, the continual light that's in the holy place, and the incense that's always burning, like there's this aura in the house with these daily things that are done. That's like, this bread is set out, there's a light always on, and there's always good smelling stuff going on. It's like, it's almost like they're trying to convey, and I would argue they are trying to convey the visual idea that God is home. And that through all of these daily rituals that God is commanding them to do, that's the idea that he wants the people to see. I am here. I am not here physically eating this food that you're giving me, because honestly, a lot of this food you're leaving out like is either burned or you eat it. But like the idea that God is present is what's being conveyed. So that is what I would argue is a better way to understand when you see food offering. First, to understand that one is probably better translated as offering a fire or gift offering, but then also to realize that it's a food offering on a symbolic level, to be teaching the idea that God is continually present with his people. The next thing we see that's a lot shorter to unpack is the term most holy, and we see that in verse 3. And it is a most holy part of the Lord's food offering. So we read that, and we might be tempted to be like, okay, well, like, this is, like, super special, or this, like, makes somebody more holy because they do this, or, like, this is, like, a better type of person that does that. But if you actually follow the context of what's going on in all of the portions in the law where it says most holy part of the Lord's offering, all it's designating is that the priests get to eat this, and just the priests. That's literally all that whole most holy part means. It's not like more spiritual or like makes anybody better. The most holy literally just means that like if something is eaten of it, it only goes to the priests. So that's literally all I have to say with that one. The next thing you see oil and frankincense. If you know anything about baking, seems kind of straightforward, but there is some symbolism also going on here. And at the most basic level, if you think about it, what's happening is the oil and the frankincense and the burning and whatever else is going on, the cooking, this would all create a pleasant smell. And we will see later in Leviticus that these elements are actually specifically left out of various offerings that involve grain, such as a version of the sin offering that we'll get to in chapter 5, and an offering of jealousy when a man suspects his wife of adultery. This is one of the many instances where we see messaging given through one of the five senses. And this one, at the most basic level, is simply a message being given through what you smell. And in this offering, it is a reminder of the covenant with God, which is basically being conveyed with a good-smelling message. Like, it is good to be in covenant with God. But then later, when you have these other grain offerings that the oil and frankincense are specifically left out of, it's essentially giving a olfactory message that not all is well. You have a sin offering, which we'll describe what that is later, but basically there's something that needs to be made right. And then you have a husband who is accusing, or like he suspects his wife of adultery, which again, there's a situation there like not all is right. We need to figure out what's going on here. So like the good smell is gone in those circumstances. But then here, where we're simply being reminded of the covenant of God, God commands that the good smell should be there. Which is just interesting that something as simple as smell is being used to teach the people. So I'm going to keep reading as we go through this offering here. Starting in verse 4. When you bring a grain offering, baked in the oven as an offering, it shall be unleavened loaves of fine flour mixed with oil, or unleavened the wafers smeared with oil. If your offering is a grain offering baked on the griddle, it shall be a fine flour unleavened mixed with oil. You shall break it in pieces and pour oil on it. It is a grain offering. If your offering is a grain offering cooked in a pan, it shall be made a fine flour with oil, and you shall bring the grain offering that is made of these things to the Lord. And when it is presented to the priest, you shall bring it to the altar, and the priest shall take from the grain offering its memorial portion, and burn on the altar a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord, but the rest of the grain offering shall be for Aaron and his sons, and is the most holy part of the Lord's food offering. And this is the part of the chapter where we read through and we're like, sleep. Because it's like the same thing again and again and again and again, just different forms of cooking. And then it's like, you're kind of like falling asleep, and then you get to 11, 13, and all of a sudden you're like, no grain offering that you bring to the Lord shall be made with leaven. You shall burn no leaven or any honey on the food offering as an offering of first fruits you may bring to the Lord, but they shall be offered on the altar, they shall not be offered as a pleasing aroma. You shall season all your grain offering with salt. You shall not let the salt of the covenant with the Lord your God be missing from the grain offering. With all your offerings you shall offer salt. All of a sudden it's like, whoa, why are we so concerned about leaven and honey and salt? Like, it's like, we read through a bunch of verses, it's like, boring, 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 like, whoa, like, why is this such a big deal? This actually is a huge deal, and we're going to unpack why there's such a strong, sudden list of restrictions and mandates that's given in 11 to 13. So, what is going on with, like, no grain offerings shall be given with leaven, you shall burn no leaven, nor any honey as a food offering, and then at the end, no salt shall ever be missing from the covenant with your God. It's like, okay, why? We're going to break down the three different elements here. Leaven, honey, and salt. Leaven. And again, remember, no leaven. Never. Like, super strong language. Don't do it. Leaven was seen as an impurity. Now, don't think of, like, a super scientific understanding of this, because that's not what's going on in this context. Ancient cultures, especially when it comes to their sacrificial systems, there's so much symbolism going on that you have to think not necessarily scientific as much as symbolic when you think about the specific elements of what's going on in something. So leaven is seen as an impurity because it changes the natural order of purity of a substance by affecting a change that you wouldn't see with just the thing itself, which is kind of a weird way of saying basically bread with leaven looks different than bread without leaven is what's going on. So in a way of thinking, again, symbolically, bread with leaven is not pure bread, is what's going on. It changes the natural order of bread. And the message being given through this prohibition is that God is a God of purity and wholeness. Which, again, like to us, it's like, what? How do they get that message? Again, you have to think on the symbolic level, not just the scientific level. There's so much messaging that is happening in the sacrificial system. So with the leaven specifically, it's God is God of purity and wholeness. In other words, like bring it back to the bread. Like God is the God of bread, not like altered bread is essentially what's happening. He's God of purity, not altered norms. Things are changed. So there's a message going on there. And then honey is actually kind of similar to this. We also see that honey was not allowed on the offerings. The word being translated as honey is also associated with the nectar of fruit, or in other words, like the fruit juice, when you squeeze a fruit, juice comes out. Either way, this word is viewed as an excretion, which we later see as a cause of impurity, and we'll talk about this a lot more later when we get to the ritual laws. But honey is basically nectar that bees vomit, in a very simplistic way of explaining what's going on. So in a way, you could say that the bee is losing something from itself. They drink the nectar, it goes into their honey stomach, and then they basically spit it up and chew it together, and then it makes honey. Long story short, so basically, like, it goes inside of them, and then they lose it. So symbolically speaking, the bee is losing something of itself to make honey. So it's an excretion or a loss, which I think loss is probably the key word there to think, not just excretion. Nectar or juice of a fruit is something that can be drawn out of the fruit. Again, if you squeeze it, it loses the juice. The juice is what is lost from the fruit. So this messaging that is going on is essentially that God is a God of life and wholeness, not a God of loss and decay. So with both of these elements, the leaven and the honey, there is a very symbolic element of what's going on here and why it's so strictly prohibited that they don't include these. Because it's what's essentially being said is that this is the type of God you are in covenant with. Because remember, this is the covenant offering, remembering that we are in covenant with God. That's also why I would argue that in 11 to 13, you have the leaven and the honey talked about first and then the salt. And we're about to realize why. The leaven and the honey are first teaching what type of God God is. And this is important because remember, Israel was not the only nation with a sacrificial system. Basically, every single nation had one. And their sacrificial systems had symbolic meanings that talked about their gods. And a lot of those included honey and leaven because you had different associations going on with the gods. And some of the gods were associated with things like the decay and the otherness and whatever. And God's like, that's not me. I am not that. I am associated with life and wholeness and purity. So there is a messaging of who God is, and then the salt is commanded in everything. So we don't do leaven and honey, but we do have salt. There are two primary reasons for this. I know that a lot. I've been saying a lot of stuff symbolic. There is a practical reason to this, but even more importantly, there is a symbolic reason that honestly the practical reason is because of the symbolism, which you'll see why. So the practical reason, salt, first, thinking practically, salt is not for taste. So that's not the practical reason, because the stuff that's salted is burnt. Nobody is eating it. So it's not for taste, that's not a practical reason. Rather, for animal offerings specifically, salt finishes the job of thoroughly draining the blood by absorbing whatever is left after it is drained so that it is not part of the sacrifice. God wanted the draining of blood to be this thorough so that the blood could not be used, as weird as this sounds to us, the blood could not be used to gain life force, is a way of thinking about it. Other cultures saw blood, rightly, because it's even seen in the Bible, we see in Genesis 4 and 9 that like blood is equated to life. So other cultures would actually have drinking blood as part of some of their offerings and ceremonies to gain life force, to gain strength, to gain vitality, to gain whatever. And in some cultures, you would even kill an animal and drink its blood to gain the power of that animal. And essentially what God is saying is, no. I am the source of life. That belongs to me. I am the source of your life. I am ultimately in charge of life and death. And you don't gain anything from drinking that blood, because that's not how that works. So he's cutting that off right at the start and saying, no, all the blood's gone. And we'll see later that it's, especially when they're out in the field, they actually are told to drain it into the ground and then cover it with dirt. Essentially what he's saying is you do everything on earth possible to make sure there's no blood involved in this because I want none of that messaging to be part of my sacrificial system. So he's very clear that this needs to be very thorough, the draining of the blood. So that's the practical messaging of the salt, which again lends to the symbolic understanding of the salt because of what's going on there. And then the other symbolic meaning of the salt, in addition to, again, the whole life force, life understanding, and we'll talk more about the life of the blood later, honestly, when we get to Leviticus 17. But in addition to this understanding, you also have some covenant symbolism that's going on. Remember, the grain offering is the covenant offering. It's a reminder of being in covenant with God. And then you even see later in verses 13 here, you shall not let the salt of the covenant with your God be missing. The salt of the covenant with your God. That phrase there is actually used twice elsewhere in Scripture and is literally, and is, I would argue, better translated as the covenant of salt, which is weird to us because you can go search through the covenants with Moses and Abraham and David and Solomon and anybody. There is literally no mention of a covenant with salt. But then when you read in the Bible and it refers back to the Davidic covenant or other covenants, it calls them a covenant of salt. So you're like, what? I don't remember anything about a covenant of salt being made. So like, what are they referring to? What they're referring to is actually an understanding of a characteristic of covenants that was conveyed through salt imagery at that time. And basically what was going on is when two parties entered a covenant that was intended to be binding and forever, salt was used. And why it was used was because the party that violated the covenant was basically saying, I know that if I don't hold up my end and I don't live by this covenant, that you have every right to come here and sow or plow my land with salt so that it can never grow. In other words, this is a big deal. Like, this is a binding covenant that has consequences if you violate it. So that's what the salt idea is conveying here. And what it's reminding the people is that, like, this isn't some flippant covenant that we've entered with God. God isn't a God that's like, well, you know, it's like, it's whatever. I'm going to enter this, but I don't really care what you do. There are no consequences if you don't honor the covenant. This is a binding covenant that has consequences, and we'll get into those later in Leviticus. So it's symbolic messaging, again, being given through the simple thing, the simple presence of salt. So again, in these verses 11 to 13, I would argue that what you have here with the leaven and the honey is characteristics of God, who this God is that you're entering covenant with. And then the salt is saying what type of covenant you are entering with this God. That's just been described through some symbolism of not having leaven or honey. So that's what's going on there in this weird, sudden, really strong prohibition and mandate section. And then as you keep going on, it says, if you offer a grain offering of first fruits to the Lord, you shall offer for the grain offering of your first fruits fresh ears, roasted with fire, crushed new grain, and you shall put on it and lay frankincense on it, and as a grain offering, the priest shall burn as a memorial portion some of the crushed grain and some of the oil with all of its frankincense as a food offering to the Lord. The last thing I want to talk about is the memorial portion. And we saw that a few times, but we see it again here. And why I specifically waited to talk about memorial portion is you kind of need to understand the salt imagery to understand what's going on with the memorial portion. And you need to understand that this is, again, a covenant offering. Like, the whole point of the offering is a reminder of the covenant. So the memorial portion here, this grain offering seasoned with salt is a reminder to the people of the covenant that they have entered with God. This is also why, like I just broke down in the last few verses, we talk about the leaven and the honey and what type of God it is that we're entering covenant with and what type of covenant it is that we're entering with this God. The fact that this offering is then called a memorial portion is why this clarification was just given about the covenant of salt. This memorial portion is basically simply a reminder of the whole purpose of this offering. It is a memorial. It is a remembrance of the covenant that was entered. So this memorial portion here is basically the core of the offering. And then some of it gets eaten, the most holy portion gets eaten by the priests, which is kind of cool if you think about it, because the Levites, remember going back into the last book, there was a golden calf incident, and then Moses went down and was really mad at the people, and he's like, all right, who's with the Lord, or who's with me? And the Levites came to him. And then they basically purged the people. God also sent a plague as a consequence for what they had done. But then in this book, you're going to see that the Levites are then installed as the priests of the covenant. And I think part of what's going on here with the fact that the Levites only get to eat this is it is basically a reminder that the Levites are in charge of maintaining faithfulness to the covenant. And that's why they get to eat a portion of the covenant offering. So there is, even in who gets to eat it, there is symbolism happening. So that is the grain offering in chapter 2. In chapter 3, we then get to the peace offering. As I mentioned earlier, this is usually an offering for thanksgiving or making vows or simply a free will offering. So I'm going to read a section of it here. Leviticus chapter 3, if his offering is a sacrifice of peace offering, if he offers an animal of the herd, male or female, he shall offer it without blemish before the Lord. He shall lay his hand on the head of the offering and kill it at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and Aaron's sons, the priests, shall throw the blood against the sides of the altar and from the sacrifice of the peace offering as a food offering to the Lord. He shall offer the fat offering, the entrails, and all the fat that is on the entrails, and the two kidneys with the fat that is on them at the loins, and the long lobe of the liver he shall remove from the kidneys, and Aaron's son shall burn it on the altar on top of the burnt offering, which is on the wood of the fire. It is an offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. The rest of the chapter is basically different animals, same thing. So we're not going to read that. You can skim through if you want. But what is going on here with the peace offering? The first thing I want to look at is this language here at the beginning. His offering is a sacrifice of peace offering. So offering, sacrifice, offering. We talked last week how there's technically speaking a difference between offering and sacrifice, and now we see them blended. So it's like, what? Are the rules gone now? So we first want to remember, okay, what technically speaking is the difference between the two? An offering, at a basic level, is just a gift to God. It's actually a very broad word, which is why you actually see them blended here, because offering is the broad word, and then sacrifice is a more specific kind of subset of offering. A sacrifice is an animal that happens to be the gift offering, and part of the animal is eaten by somebody. So basically, a sacrifice is an animal, part of which is eaten in a communal meal, either by just the priest or by the people and the priests or some combination. So that's why you have it is an the offering is a sacrifice of peace offering, because it is a broadly speaking offering, but specifically in that broad context, it is a sacrifice, because you'll see that there's an animal involved. And in this chapter, you don't read about the fact that it is eaten, but that's specifically laid out later in Leviticus chapter 7. You'll see that it talks about here, like the fat portions, that goes to God. And then in Leviticus 7, we read that the breast and the right thigh go to the priests, and then the rest goes to the offerer and their friends and family, basically whoever's involved in this offering. Because a lot of times in that culture, something that's being done is not done on an individual level. Like, we're a very individualistic culture. We're like, if I'm doing something, I'm doing something. In that culture, especially at that time, if I'm doing something, my family is doing something. So a lot of times, all these offerings, like, don't just think of the individual level. Like, even when I was talking about the purposes, like, say somebody's going through something difficult circumstances, so I'm going to make a vow. Honestly, a lot of times it was the family made a vow, because the family is going through difficult circumstances. And then the family comes to God and gives a thanksgiving peace offering later when God brings them through it. So a lot of these things are done on the group level. But either way, this is the first time we see sacrificial language, because this is the first time there's an animal involved and part of it is eaten, because in chapter 1, the whole thing was burnt. And like I just walked through, as far as like who gets to eat it, we've actually seen a development in these chapters. In the burnt offering, nobody eats it. None of it. It's all burnt. God, if I think the skin was able to be used. But then the next offering, the grain offering, just the priests eat it. And then this offering, the priests and the people eat it. We'll get to later in the application why that's significant. But just realize that there is a build here of who gets to eat it. And then the next thing of note is this weird section of details about the fats. And again, just reading it's, he shall offer the fat offering, the entrails, and all the fat that is on the entrails, and the two kidneys with the fat that is on them, at the loins, and the long lobe of the liver. And again, like, this is just one of those things we read and we're like, that's way too much detail. Like, what on earth is going there? There's a lot of uncertainty about what is exactly going on here. So I'm going to present like the two most plausible views, but you'll even find other views than these. So the first one is the assumption that the fat going on here in all of these different parts of the body, the fatty portion was generally speaking a idiom for like the best portion of a sacrifice. So basically the thought there is that okay, you have the three different groups who are eating. God gets some of it, the priest gets some of it, and the people get some of it, which, again, remember that the first one, God eating it, is symbolic. But basically what it's saying is God gets the best, and then the priest gets two really good portions, and then the people get the rest. So they would argue that's what's going on. This seems to be supported by 1 Samuel 2:29, where Eli is confronted by God for honoring his sons above God by allowing them to get fat on the choicest portions of the offerings, which, again, choicest portions of the offerings, the language seems to be indicating that that Eli's sons are eating the portions that are supposed to go to God, which is why Eli is basically scolded for saying that he's honoring the sons above God, because they're getting God's portion. So that seems to support that the fatty portions basically means the best portions. An alternate view, and honestly, these two could work together, because so many times, especially in the Old Testament, when you have debates over what something means, more than half the time, I would argue it's all of the above. But another view of what's happening is that this is another symbolic teaching point. And why it would be a teaching point is because the kidneys and the liver, if you look into the use of those items in other cultures, oftentimes those were used for some sort of divination or something. Not always, but depending on the culture, you have some sort of magical or cultural thing going on there. And what could be going on is that God is saying, okay, you guys are going to burn a portion of it for me. I want you to burn the portion that you could be using for not so great things. So like that stuff that you could be doing with those portions that the other nations do, we're going to burn that so that doesn't happen. So that could be going on. And honestly, again, you could have both. So there's, again, sorry, some ambiguity there, but those are two, what I would argue, two very plausible explanations for the breakdown here of what's being burnt. And this is a freebie, but if you're curious about the tail of the from the flock, the lamb, like the sheep that were common at that time actually had long tails. Like, we're not used to that with the sheep that we think of, but they some sources estimate anywhere from like 15 to 50 pounds of a tail, which to us is like huge. But it is just a different type of sheep. So that's what's going on there. And then at the end in verse 17, we're going to skip there. It says, "This shall be a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwelling places, that you shall neither eat fat nor blood." So this is kind of like chapter 2, where it's all of a sudden like really strong statement. It's like, okay, why? So the fat and the blood, we talked about the fat. Honestly, either of those interpretations lends itself to this prohibition. Like, if it's the choicest portions go to God, basically it's this shall be a continual reminder for you that God gets the first portion, and then you go from there. This is a continual statute for you that you don't do those things that the other cultures are doing, because that's not the type of God that I am. That's not how you get guidance. So either way works. And then the second one, you shall not eat blood. This is something that we kind of talked about earlier, and again, it will be developed later. But for now, just remember that as early as Genesis 4 and 9, blood is equated with life, and life comes from God. And again, many cultures were using the blood for things like life force or getting power or getting attributes of a person or an animal or something. And God is just strictly prohibiting any of that understanding from being part of his sacrificial system. So that's what's going on with the prohibitions there in chapter 3. So sorry if some of that was a little boring, but you need to understand all of that symbolism to understand what is going on with these sacrifices. We read, especially the offerings and the sacrifices of Leviticus, and we're just like, yeah, I got nothing. What's going on? And the biggest part of that is because we're not living it. We're not part of that symbolism that's going on. We have Bibles, so like we're not looking to all these visual things to be teaching us, but like that was the Bible of the people. There's so much teaching and messaging and symbolism going on in even just these first three chapters. So now that we understand what is going on in these offerings, what on earth does any of this have to do with us? The first thing I want to talk about is something we started talking about last week. Last week we talked about how every believer is now a priest offering up spiritual sacrifices. And you see this in Hebrews and 1 Peter and other places. But in the Old Covenant, you had the Levites, the priestly class. Like, they were the priests, everybody else was not priests. sneak peek into something going forward. One of those weird prohibitions, like you shouldn't wear mixed clothing. If you actually look at what the priests were commanded to wear, they wore mixed clothing. And the prohibition against mixed clothing is basically saying you aren't priests. So that's a little sneak peek into a weird command that comes later. But you take that understanding into the new covenant, and it makes it even more radical and amazing that we are all priests. So we are all priests who are commanded to offer up spiritual sacrifices every day. And we think about that in relation to these first three offerings and what's talked about as us as priests and Christ, what he did. So the first one we talked about last week, the burnt offering, fellowship with God, and how that needed to be done all the time, and every time you wanted to enter sacred space, you had to give this burnt offering. And we talked about how in Hebrews and other places, it talks about how Christ, through his sacrifice, gave a perfect and permanent burnt offering so that we have constant access to Christ. And we talk about the symbolism of the putting the blood on the altar, about like how the burnt offering was trying to get access to God, and then the blood of it was put on the altar to basically purify the altar of you, that you have entered sacred space, and it needs to be cleansed of your presence. So now God and you are able to have fellowship. And that's also why we're told that Christ's blood is sprinkled on us, because we are also now the temple. We're not just priests, we're also the temple. And the blood is sprinkled on us because we are purified permanently to have fellowship with God. So there's a lot of layers going on here that are being picked up with that first offering. So what's going on with these second two offerings? Well, something else we see in the New Testament is that we are called to continually offer the spiritual equivalent of grain and peace offerings to God every day. And you're like, okay, where'd you get that one? A more general term for sacrifices is used in the New Testament, which sometimes appears to refer to peace offerings. Remember Hosea's insistence and Micah's insistence that God desires mercy and a contrite heart rather than sacrifices. And this is quoted by Christ multiple times, specifically in Matthew 9:13 and 12:7. Essentially what's going on here with the spiritualizing of the sacrifices, which honestly isn't spiritualizing, because this whole Old Testament thing, like all these prohibitions, mandates, commands, all this weird stuff, God was never interested in that we go through. That is the same today as it was in the Old Covenant. The idea of continual spiritual sacrifice is taken further in the epistles when Paul urges the Romans to offer their bodies as living sacrifices, which is your spiritual worship. And then Hebrews then invites us to continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God that is the fruit of lips that acknowledge his name. Do not neglect to do good and to share what you have, for such sacrifices are pleasing to God. And that's Hebrews 13, 15 to 16. I would argue that that pleasing to God phrase in Hebrews, a book steeped with Old Testament imagery, specifically Leviticus imagery, the author of Hebrews did not intend his authors to miss the significance of that phrase, the pleasing to God. Read back through these first three chapters. How many times have we seen that? Pleasing aroma to God. I would argue that that was not accidental at all by the author of Hebrews to use that pleasing to God phrase to specifically bring to mind these first three offerings. Just as the priests were commanded to offer daily sacrifices to God, so we are commanded to offer daily sacrifices as well of our heart and our life. The priests in the Old Covenant had to do the motions of the sacrificial system and do all these ceremonies and stuff. We still are commanded to be doing the heart of everything that they were doing in the Old Covenant today in our lives in the New Covenant. The second thing that is a point of application here is something that we do every other month in this church, the Lord's Supper. Because again, remember I said I get back to the significance of who eats what for the offerings. Even more directly related to the Old Testament peace offering is our current Lord's Supper that's been mandated for us by Christ to do continually as in remembrance of him until he comes. At the Last Supper, Jesus referred to the cup of wine as the new covenant in my blood. In so doing, he alluded to the covenant of the Old Testament. Remember in Exodus 24 that I had read that Moses sprinkled the people with the blood during that kind of the commencement of the covenant. The Last Supper was more like a peace offering than a burnt offering, though, in that the peace offering and the Last Supper were both meals, while the burnt offering never was. Christ's death on the cross is a close parallel to the burnt offering. All of it is given to God. His sharing of his body and blood with his disciples forms a closer parallel to the peace offering. However, the most striking contrast between the peace offering and the Lord's Supper is the use of the imagery of blood. In the Old Covenant, specifically, you do not drink any blood. It is to be no part of any sacrifice or meal. And even if you're in the field and you're dressing an animal, get rid of all the blood. In the New Covenant, Christ is like, this is my blood, take a drink. And we're like, whoa, what happened? Especially if you're a Jew reading that, you're like, no. Like, we're not supposed to. And that's, by the way, when Jesus is talking to the crowds and he's like, this is like, you have to drink my blood, you have to eat my body and drink my blood. They're super offended by it because of this. Under the New Covenant, we're expressly commanded to be drinking blood. Now, it's wine, not actually blood. But, like, the symbolism is the opposite that it was in the Old Covenant. So what's going on? It is blood that makes atonement for sin, and by drinking it, the Christian is constantly reminded that he is saved by God and not of his own efforts. According to the Old Testament, the life enshrined in the blood was sacred because it was God-given. Man had no right to take this God-implanted life. It must be returned directly to the Creator. Now, in the New Testament era, or the New Covenant, this atoning and life-giving power may be drunk by the creature to purge him of his sins and assure him of God's salvation. The Lord's Supper, therefore, is like a peace offering, solemn and joyful. Solemn because no human can lightheartedly join into this covenant and enter God's presence and pledge to keep his laws. But it's also joyful because God's grace and his promise exceed all that we can ask or think in this life and the next. And you think about that, it's like, okay, what did any of that have to do with blood? Think about what's going on here. In the Old Covenant, you don't touch the blood. Like, life comes from me. That is all mine. I am the source of all of that. And in the New Covenant, he uses that blood to purify us permanently. They build on each other. In the Old Testament, you had nothing to do with that. Like, that was nothing that gave you power. You didn't use it for any purpose. And in the New Covenant, he's like, yeah, that thing that is all mine, that I am the source of, I am using to now purify you forever. You still have nothing to do with it. That comes from me. So when we have the Lord's Supper and we are commanded to partake of Christ's body and his blood, we remember the perfect burnt offering. And then we also remember the perfect peace offering with elevated symbolism that something is commanded to us that was prohibited in the Old Covenant because it is now being used for an even greater purpose. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you for this book. It has been a joy already to study and to read into. I thank you for how understanding what is going on with all these weird offerings and sacrifices and rituals and laws. I thank you for how much more meaning this gives to the New Covenant and what you have made possible for us today. I thank you for how it can help us to understand the significance and the awesomeness of what your sacrifice has made possible for us, how you have perfectly fulfilled the law for us, made fellowship with you possible, and have cleansed us to be in your presence, and more than that, to be your presence here on earth as we are your temple with the Holy Spirit inside of us. I pray all this in your name. Amen.